attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. Today I've caught Paul Devan. Paul is currently tipping the considerable contents of his massive marketing mind in the direction of Miro, where he's the head of brand marketing and presumably the sworn enemy of post-it note people everywhere. A leading thinker or preeminent ponderer in the field of marketing effectiveness, Paul has been making marketing that makes things happen for the past 20 odd years, with senior roles at O2, Telefonica and Indeed, as well as a successful spell as CMO of the National Lottery in Ireland. He's too nice for us to be disgusted at the sheer variety and volume of his achievements, so we should also mention he was named Ireland's Marketer of the Year in 2022 and has written a great business book, Run with Foxes, Making Better Marketing Decisions. Paul says AI isn't threatening your brand's distinctive assets. It's their best friend, their superpower, their steroids. Your logo, your colours, your mascot, your jingle. AI turns each one into a nuclear-powered brand code. AI is not the enemy of distinctive assets. It's the greatest amplification tool they've ever had. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thanks, Jazz. Well, you make me sound very, very wonderful. I think the main word is pondering that you should take away from that entire introduction. But it is lovely to be here. And I think the word great under my book is a very subjective description of it. But I'll take whatever you're giving.
Right. Fair enough. Right. Ponder your way through these quick fires then. So a couple of easy ones to start. London or Dublin?
Yeah, Dublin.
B2B or B2C?
B2C.
Foxes or hedgehogs?
Foxes.
Big green water slide or turtle in a sports car?
Big green water slide.
Artificial intelligence or human stupidity?
Ooh, I'm going to have to go with artificial intelligence.
Okay. Right, this one's mildly ridiculous. Post-it notes or post-it no?
I am a fan of post-it notes, but I'm going to say post-it no for now.
Cool. Right, I'm going to end on this one. Number 7, build the future or study the past?
Oh, that's a difficult one, to be fair. I'm going to say, I don't know if I should say both. Like, you got to study the past. Like, there's just no getting around the study of the past, but you can't get stuck in it. So I'm going to have to say yeah. a bit of both for that one.
Nice. So, I was the 8th one, which I've chosen to ignore because I don't want probably our mutual friend Shane O'Leary to message me, was brand or performance. But I think, you know, there's a chapter on that in your book. And we'll get to that at some point, perhaps. We'll see. But listen, I'm hugely grateful for you finding time to come on. The first thing we ask every guest for good reason is to tell our listeners about their first ever job and then what they regard to be their first kind of proper job. So could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, my first job where I got paid, I worked in a hospital as a porter when I was 16. It was great. My dad was a doctor and he got me this job during the summer to work in the hospital, but they didn't really know what to do with me. So I just had to push wheelchairs around the hospital, but I managed to read 7 books while I was working during that summer. So it was quite a productive work for me, but I never got paid before. It was amazing. So that was pretty good for a while.
Do you remember any of the books that you read, or were there any significant ones that have stayed with you?
I do. I read It by Stephen King at the time, which was quite a big book.
Okay.
And then a bunch of other ones. My dad used to feed me all sorts of books. I've got twin boys who are 9, and what I really want them to do is learn to love reading. I think if they can capture that one habit, they'll be successful. So yeah.
Yeah, I've got 2 girls actually. One loves reading and the other one is whatever the other end of the spectrum looks like.
Yeah, it's the same for me a little unfortunately.
Okay, cool. And then what was your first proper job? So I know you went to university in Dublin.
So actually, when I came out of college, I was a care worker. So I used to work with kids at risk. So, you know, like kids that would steal your car and things like that. And I did that for about a year and a bit. And then realized that I was probably the only person there who was reading like marketing stuff at the time. And then I decided to quit that. And I got a job working. Like it was a marketing job, but it was a really lightweight marketing job. But I learned an awful lot about direct marketing at the time there as well. And then straight after that, I got a job working in the first internet boom. So I started working for a search engine marketing agency in 1999. So like I say that Google and myself both got into search at the same time, but they seemed to have done a little bit better than I did.
That's probably fair to say. So your time in further education, we should call it, was obviously marketing based from the off, which isn't uncommon, but it's not always the way. I think people I've interviewed in the past, there's often some kind of serendipity at play as to how they ended up where they are. Were you interested in marketing when you took that course? Because I think it's probably not always correct to assume that.
Yeah, no, I have. So like my dad, if he was alive now, would tell you that like at the age of 11 or 12, I used to show him newspaper ads and ask him about them. And he just thought I was weird. And I was like, Dad, look at this ad. And like, this is like Sunday newspapers. And this was a really early age. And then he bought me like David Ogilvy's Ogilvy on Advertising at it, like in the 80s. And when I finished school, I did work placement. I did it in an ad agency when I was like 16. And then I used to send letters to companies with ads, like, here's a script idea. Like, this is how naive I was, but I was only young. And then when I finished school, I applied to do an advertising diploma in university. And my dad persuaded me to do a broader degree. So he was like, that's a bit narrow. Why don't you do like a business degree? So I ended up doing like a business degree in Trinity with marketing as a part of that. So I feel like I've been in the world and trying to study the world of marketing communications since a really young age. I really like it.
Yeah. And your career history is really interesting. And I say that from the angle of having spoken to lots of people who, as I say, either kind of tripped over and fell into the world or have quite a broad range of experiences outside of marketing. But your profile reads very much marketing manager, brand campaign manager, head of brand, brand director. So it actually seems quite linear. Did it feel linear?
Yeah, it is. Like the truth is I have like very few hobbies or any general interest outside this very specific type of thing.
Yeah.
I worked at O2 for about 10 years and the ongoing joke was I had just the same job over and over. And it's funny because I make very active decisions about these things. I'm not cautious at all. I'm the opposite of cautious, but I am very focused about decisions about what to do. And I often turn down opportunities if I don't think they're aligned to the stuff that I like to do that I think I could be good at. And like I'll veer around those things and I'll try new things. But like I was offered like a head of digital when I was in O2 and it was a promotion, but I said no. I was like, I don't want to get into digital transformation and architecture. That's not what I enjoy doing. I really enjoy marketing communications and I really enjoy everything that's kind of at the sweet spot of marketing. And so, yeah, it does look like it's a very linear, and not linear, it's not always going up, but it's a very small circle of stuff that I've stayed within because I enjoy it. And I don't think you can get really good at something unless you act, as in you're not going to be better than everyone else unless you genuinely enjoy it, I think.
Yeah, no, there's nothing wrong with that. And I think that's entirely true and very fair. Very fair to say. What do you mean by the sweet spot of marketing?
So, well, I can tell you what my sweet spot is. So yeah. I like customer understanding. So anything around research and insights and like listening to customers and understanding customers. I like that an awful lot. I like the world of advertising and marketing communications, so the promotional piece. And I'm really interested in just brands generally. So like brand management. And like for a while, I didn't know the difference between those two things, but they're very different. And so those three areas, I've tried to not veer outside and have them as part of what I do. And like the things I'm not that good at, like I'm not a pricing specialist. Like you wouldn't want to come to me to figure out your pricing strategy. I discovered when I joined Miro, there's a world of product marketing in, like, coming from a tech, like 20 years of it, like a tech world, which I didn't really understand existed to the level that it existed. And it's not my sweet spot either. So, you know, the way most people who don't know anything about marketing, they all think it's the promotional P. That's mostly what I'm interested in. So, like, even the name of the book, you know, so it's Make Marketing Decisions, like, you know, Better Marketing Decisions, the Enrollment Foxes. Like, a lot of this stuff in the book is still in the world of advertising and marketing communications. So I kind of apologize up front because I don't want to further the misunderstanding that marketing is marketing communications. It just happens to be the area I've spent most of my time in.
Yeah, I like that. To be honest, I really like the term sweet spot at marketing. And I appreciate that's going to be relatively subjective to some people. But I think if yours, as it does, starts with kind of research and customer, that it, you know, it sounds probably broader than I expected, given you ended it by saying you like the promotional P. And in fact, there's a chapter in your book, which I will link to in this episode's listing, about brand campaign selling. So actually, there's a real truth that kind of merges the kind of brand and performance all into one. Again, I'd like to use the word sweet spot, but I don't want to take your words and mangle them and to mean something else.
No, it's all right. It's more about my sweet spot. You know what I mean? Like, I think it depends on the category. It depends on the life stage of a company as well.
Yes. What inspired you to write the book?
Oh, this is a bunch of reasons. Can I just tell you the bunch of reasons? And then, so here they are. If I can remember, I like to write. I think writing helps me clarify things. So, and I enjoy writing. Like, I really like words. Like, I enjoy writing and reading. So that's one. Another reason is I just quit my job. I was traveling too much. I had these twin boys who were really young, and I decided I could take some time off, and I did. And I said, "Oh, it might be interesting to do something while I'm not working." And so I used to write in the mornings. I think that was another reason. The other thing is the book is a basic load of things and mistakes that I kind of wish I'd known about a little bit later in life. And I really wished that I had known these things when I was 26, 27. And so part of it was, it wouldn't be wonderful if someone is 26, 27 and doesn't have to spend like 15 years making these mistakes themselves. And then the other couple of reasons was I just fancied the challenge of whether I could get a book published. And then the other kind of more selfish motivation is I wondered, would it help me career-wise at some stage to have a book published? I think a lot of people, they like the idea that someone has written a book, even if they don't read it.
Yeah.
So this is a whole bunch of things that collectively felt like something I would do, even though I'm not sure if I could justify them against any one reason.
Were there a therapy of sorts? Because, I mean, it's described as a treasure trove of confessions of an experienced marketer.
That's from Peter Field. Yeah. So it was actually Peter's idea to write it, actually.
Okay.
I should thank him for a lot of things, but I should thank him for that. But I tell you what, it forced me to go back. It did force me to go back and go a little bit deeper on some of the mistakes I made and like just question why. I tell you what, having written the book, I'm a better marketer, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yeah, it makes complete sense. Peter goes on to say it's helpful and comforting in equal measure. And I think that's a better way of articulating what I was going to say, in that it's a very intelligent book, and yet it's also quite, not intimidatingly, like unnervingly humble as well. Yet it's really intelligent. As in, you can tell someone experienced and wise has written it, and yet because it is a collection of stories and anecdotes, and it trips into kind of errors and mistakes of logic and thinking, it's also like a really, it's very rewarding to read.
Yeah, I'm really happy with the book. It's been a few years since I've read it, but there weren't that many books out there that were written from a client perspective. And also, I wasn't really selling anything, like, apart from the book. But what I was trying to do is talk to a very broad audience in a way that's simple, but acknowledge that these are smart people. And I also wanted to get to the crux of the fact that, like, we are going to make mistakes, and we should learn from them, and we should figure out how to learn from them, but not necessarily feel shame about them. And I wanted to kind of give an honest appraisal of not just the mistakes, but like how you end up making those mistakes. And then maybe are there ways to not make them in the future. So that's kind of the genesis of it. And I tried to write, they're very short chapters, like they're only like 3 pages each. I was kind of writing them for the commute, and then COVID kicked in and there was no commute. But but like I launched it like April 2020, you know, in the middle of lockdown.
Yeah.
So, but that was kind of thinking, because I also think people like to get books read. A lot of people don't like to read books. They just want to get through them.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
Unfortunately, so.
Yeah, no, I'm one of those. I am one of those. Are there many mistakes that you've witnessed since the book was first published, which was 5 years ago now, or coming up to 5 years ago now, that you think would fit into the book? I mean, we're living through a big one now, and I don't want this to sound like a seamless segue into talking about, you know, the world of AI and how hesitant people are.
Yeah, like there's a bunch of mistakes. We make the same mistakes over and over. Like, this is the truth. So, like, what I would say is this. I, like, you know, I think, like, you've had him on your show, but, like, Paul Feldwick is probably the wisest man in advertising. And I only discovered Paul's writing, like, late in my career, and like it's like 15 years ago, maybe longer, but it's still late. And all these things that I'd wonder about and had points of view on, like it was all there. Like he'd written about them in his daily work, or which was called Ad something beforehand. And so I was like kicking myself for going, oh my god, like, you know, like all this work from Stephen King and all this work from Paul Feldwick, all this amazing stuff that, like, would have answered a lot of these silly mistakes I made. So I think as marketers, we don't study the past, and we just keep reinventing, making up new models and all sorts of crazy stuff. And it's all there. And then you can't get stuck in the past. Like, you got to be ready to understand that, like, the stuff that was, like, the results we got from before may not be the same this time because something's changed. But that's just getting into critical thinking. But yeah, so there's a whole bunch of mistakes that we make. But I even made some of the mistakes again, Giles, that I wrote about in the book. And like I having written the book, I still managed to make some of these mistakes, like, afterwards, and like reasonably big ones. So, you know, my dad used to say, you know, anyone can learn from mistakes, like a wise person learns from other people's mistakes. And I was like, we're not even learning from our own mistakes. So I think that's part of it. But then I also believe if you're not making mistakes, you're probably not making any decisions. And so I've really come to, I guess my biggest learning from this is, like, you can become good at making decisions. You can follow a better process for making decisions that reduces the risks of a bad outcome. But actually, don't focus just on the outcome. Focus on your decision-making process. That's kind of the big learning I took away from that.
Yeah, totally. No, I'm pleased you've name-checked Paul Feldwick, because it's funny. I come to this conversation with a, you know, similar, I think we're a similar vintage. With a similar kind of learning curve, if you like, of only discovering the likes of Paul, although, you know, being familiar with his work growing up, the likes of Jeremy Bulmore, who I think is probably one of the greatest thinkers we've ever had. And actually, retrospectively, you can be quite frustrated that you hadn't read all of their work previously. And yet, I suppose there's also something that comes from experiencing something to conclude what they have subsequently written in order to learn from your mistakes. It's like, yeah. I mean, your point about people reinventing things and rebadging things. I remember talking to, I think it was Rich Huntington a few years ago, about brief templates and how one of my kind of pet hates is people coming up or trying to reinvent a template for a brief. Because my response is always that, you know, far smarter people than I have already done that. And whether it's BBH's classic brief template or JWT, there's one from the 60s, which I regularly, you know, lean on. It just seems a bit a waste of resource to try and create something that's already out there.
Yeah, sure. Stephen King's JWT one is free. It was written in March 1974 and is available free as a PDF on the internet. Like, it's there. Like, where are we? How do we get here? Like, you know, what would we need to do for things to change? Like, it's a fairly straightforward planning cycle, and there's, like, you know, there's a brief to fall straight out of that. But yeah, I do think people, I was talking about this to a friend of mine yesterday, people like shortcuts, and they like what's the easy answer. And that's not a good thing. As in, like, it just because people don't think, it's a bit like all of the stuff that goes on with like 60-40 kind of idea and the 95 rule. And like, I remember, but like, I've had the luxury of Peter Field training me several times over many years, and I've had the luxury of Paul training me and my team several times over a number of years. And I got an opportunity to quiz Peter like on an ongoing basis about everything he'd written. And, you know, he's a gent, but he's like, it doesn't really matter. He's like, look, so these are broad findings. You got to look at your data. Like you can't ignore your own circumstances. You can't just take a rule and apply it to your situation and think that's going to be okay.
Yeah. There's a few kind of, I suppose, more classical references there, whether it's, you know, Paul talking about fame and Stephen King in his amazing planning cycle and his wisdom of old. How are the two worlds of classical and modern marketing colliding at the moment? And have you lived through anything as significant as AI and that's AI's effects on the industry?
So the second part of your question is, I haven't. I think that search, like, completely changed budgets and all sorts of marketing stuff over a period of 10 years or something like that. And I think social media had a real big impact. And I think even before my time, the split of creative and media that happened probably in the 80s was a big deal. But nothing compares to what AI is going to do to marketing. Nothing. Like, it's not about AI making things faster or cheaper or anything like that. It's actually going to change how we do all these things. And the problem is it's ever pervasive. Like, it's like saying, what can a computer do or what can the internet do? Like, the internet is in all parts of our lives, from everything from, you know, WhatsApp to turning on your heat and like what shows you watch, booking your flights. AI is just cutting through all these things at a pace that is hard to keep up with. So I think people think it's hype, and sometimes it sounds like hype. I like continuously surprised about all the things that AI is starting to show what it can do and what we can do with it. It's terrifying and fun at the same time.
Time, weather, and
we interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on proper marketing. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
Marketing is incredibly confused with sales.
I think you're the one who's more confused, Gary V. Sunshine. Here we go.
I think people confuse being against a particular application of AI as the same thing as being against AI. And I don't know, this is probably a really clumsy metaphor, but to me it's like someone dismissing a kettle when it was first invented, therefore dismissing or assuming dismiss electricity. Because I know electricity is a significant thing. That particular execution or application is probably nonsense, or could be nonsense.
It's true. Like, it's like my mom says, she doesn't like movies. I was like, what, you don't like any movie? Like, or you just don't like, you don't like the concept of a movie? But it's, yeah, exactly. Like the thing is this, they're very, very broad range of things, and they're very different to each other. So it's hard to have a conversation about AI and be just about one thing, because there's a whole bunch of other things you could be talking about that are also AI. And even when you get a little bit narrower, which is AI for marketing, which is the bit that I'm most interested in, it's multi-range. It's a whole bunch of things. But I don't know how you feel about this, but I do think some people are like, it's, you know, like, it's coming for our jobs. That's one aspect. Another one is it's not as good. You know, so therefore I'm going to dismiss it. And that's a really dangerous position to take, because just because it's not particularly good right now, it's getting so much better, so much quicker, that it would be really naive to think that it's not going to be good in a number of months or a year.
Yeah, I also think it's so overwhelming that it's almost our ape brains find it easier to dismiss the entire thing than to try and wrap your head around its potential application. And a lot of that application is probably a few years away from even being, you know, a reality or even, you know, a dream, let's be honest, because of how fast it's accelerated. If we do narrow in on AI in its current guise, are there any kind of particular use cases or examples that you can share with our listeners where you think there is value to explore? Because you've been on like a real kind of AI focused journey quite publicly on LinkedIn for a few months now.
Yeah. So I think there's probably four areas right now where I see it adds value for marketing functions. The first thing I think is it may allow very small marketing teams to compete with larger marketing teams. I genuinely think that if I was to create a marketing function from scratch for a company or design one of them, it would be quite different to what I would have done a couple of years ago. But I think practically, so if you start with the easy stuff, like just artwork and images and all that stuff, like a lot of companies they spend money to create branded artwork and a whole range, a library of images and artwork that they use all the time. Like I remember years ago, like doing photo shoots just to create a bank of artwork for O2 and things like that. And you need that stuff for your company, for your brand. But like, there is no reason to spend that kind of money again on doing those kind of photo shoots for most companies. I'm not saying there aren't exceptions to the rule, but
sure, of course.
I don't. So there's an immediate saving on that, and it's immediate. Like people say, well, you can just use stock, but you can't, like you're using stock photography. It's hard to find the exact thing you want, you know? So there's that one. That's kind of basic level stuff. The next step up from that is like video. So like video has always been a trade-off for marketing functions. Like, should we create video? We think video would be better. Like, we'd be better to have video in our ads, video content. Like, it just feels like it'd be better than having like static stuff. But there's a trade-off. Like, it costs more to make. It takes longer to make. That trade-off is disappearing at speed. And so there is no reason why lots of organizations, small companies, big companies, can have lots of video without spending the money to make it. So they're two obvious ones. The one I like most is I use Claude like every day. And I use it as a coworker. I would review things with Claude, get Claude's opinion, ask Claude to like, oh, I've got this brand positioning that I'm thinking of. Can you write 3 blog posts and show me how it would work for each type of these messages? But can you write it for this persona or for this persona? Could you, like, I can say, here's a radio script. Can you write me similar radio scripts with the same structure, same format, same wit? But change the audience and talk about X instead. In the same way that I would work with a highly talented creative team or even a planner or strategist. And that stuff is extraordinarily good. And I don't think people use it to a fraction of what they can do. Tom Roach was asking me, do I think any of it's better than real strategists? And my answer is, they're not going to be as good as Tom. And they're not going to be as good as kind of a Peter Field or a Paul Feldwick. But yeah, it's a lot better than a lot of the planning stuff I see out there, like, to be honest with you. Yeah. So, but you put that stuff in the hands of a really talented strategist and you get real fast kind of, you can basically get a month's worth of work done in a day or two. So it's not like a click, it's ongoing. Like I might have like a 1,000 chats with Claude trying to work something out.
Yeah.
That's really, really good. Like I might show my marketing plan suggestion with my budgets and get Claude to critically review it, and then it makes a mockery of me. So it's really good like that. And you can ask it to be critical. You can say, look, be critical, like, don't be nice, compare this with that, tell me where you think are the flaws, like, tell me why, and then you get a bit of a debate. It's really good. And then I guess the last part is the kind of world of AI agents, where at one level you just have, you know, you set up some workflows. I've used make.com, but I'm also like spending time with Relevance AI, where you can create workflows where you set everything up in the background, you click a button and all these agents go off and brief each other and they pass information along. So you can get an OpenAI agent to do some research on the internet and then brief Claude to write it. And then you can get Claude to brief another Claude bot to review the first one and then spit that back out to you, and then you can have a look at it again. So like, those possibilities are endless. And I think at the moment for marketing, not even to get into the world of research, which is really interesting as well, I think those four areas are right here and right now available to people to drive faster work, get to good quality work, take out like handovers. Handovers really bother me. You know, the time you lost handing something one over to another person. So I think they're the real gains right now. in like that I see happening that I'm trying to make happen myself.
Amazing. I think those last two are really interesting, especially because they feel a step or two on from the first two in terms of creating images, art, video, whatever it might be. And of course, in certain contexts, the first two are going to be infinitely more powerful depending on circumstances. But it's really interesting because it's almost like with Claude and also AI and agents, it becomes this kind of engine of sorts that didn't previously exist.
Yeah, like they do different things. So like the like artwork and imagery is the low-hanging fruit and video. I didn't mention there, but I've started to try and do proper advertising. So like, you've got video, you've got different types of video. Like you've got like, you know, talking head avatars, which is big in the B2B world. And I spend a little bit of time with those. But we actually, like myself and a couple of really talented creatives and a really talented strategy guy, we spent like 3 or 4 weeks working on making a proper ad, the kind of stuff that you'd spend like 3 or 4 months making. And then we tested it as well to see how it did, like how it would do. And it's okay. There's some limitations. Like you end up going towards a certain style to overcome the constraints of AI. But this was end of last year. But like it's very conceivable that a lot of advertising could be done through AI without a shoot. It's not going to be your 5-star on System One ads, but like most brands don't even do that. And the other thing is, I think even those who are going to do shoots, I think they, if they're smart, they're thinking about how will we exploit the long tail of this shoot with AI. For example, like the lottery stuff I did a few years ago, a lot of water slides. If I was in the lottery making those ads now, I'd have thought through, what do I want to capture so that I can like continuously amplify these assets in using AI? And even to the extent like do a deal with a character asset who's an actor, do a deal with him where he's shooting and he's in the ads, but then we're going to use his identity and even avatar for the long tail of smaller activation work. And thinking about it that way is pretty good.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense if you can kind of do a deal for that IP. The way you're using Claude currently, I mean, it's wide-ranging, but one of the instances you spoke of asking Claude to write to a particular segment or persona.
Yeah.
That obviously, Claude has to be informed by something.
Yeah.
So that doesn't, to me, it doesn't feel a million miles away from synthetic research of sorts. What do you think about the world of synthetic research? Have you explored that at all?
I have a little bit. So, like, I'm a big fan of John and Peter in Evidenza, and you know John Lombardo.
Yeah, we had him on recently, actually. Yes.
Yeah, they're great. So I've looked at some of their stuff, and Phil Barden has from like Decoded. He's invested in a thing called BrainSuite, I think it's called, which I've looked at.
That's right.
Too.
Yeah, like a German.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
AI, yeah.
And then there's another tool from a credit called Neuron that I've looked at as well, where it's like we're basically get to the stage where I'm getting robots to review work made by robots, but the they're like, doesn't feel human enough. But the I'm definitely interested in it, and I've read about the challenges and the like, for example, how hard is it to gain real insight from synthetic data, from where is it pulling it from? So I think in some areas it won't be as good, but in other areas, I think it's worth testing. So use it, test it, and then test it against real people and see how similar or different the responses are, and do that for a while and find out whether actually it is good or not. But I'm pretty bullish about it. I'm certainly interested I've definitely been interested in trying and exploring it. And I guess we'll see what it's good at and what it's not, but for sure, yeah.
Yeah, and it sounds like a really healthy position to be in as much as you're open to seeing what it's good and what it's bad at.
Yeah, I made that point recently on LinkedIn, which is like, it goes back to the book and the ideology between hedgehogs and foxes. If you believe one thing is the answer to everything and you see everything through that lens, then you'll be biased and you won't be open to being wrong. But if you're willing to, like, it's different between skeptical and cynical. So I would always recommend people be skeptical. I would recommend, I think it's good. Don't just believe what you read. Like, go look for the underlying research. Like, read the assumptions. Find out where that piece of information originated and how. But don't be cynical. Like, don't close your mind to the idea that it might not be true. And I think that's a really important thing for marketers. Like, the people fall into both camps. You fall into, they believe everything they read and they think everything's true and they haven't gone any way deeper and they just make silly mistakes. And then you get those who are jaded, who are just cynical and they don't want to hear anything about it because it doesn't fit with their mental model of how things work. So it's like everything else. So I think people should just click on buttons. So when it comes to AI, I'm always like, oh, what does this button do? You know, I'd be on Perplexity and I was like, oh, if I change the lens here and click on this button, what happens? So I do think as a kind of a view in the world, people should click on buttons and see what happens.
That's not a tip for pilots though.
No, there are instances where like that might not be a good idea, but I genuinely think that like it's about being curious, but I think people should they should take time to go, oh, like I wonder, is this actually true? And I wonder if I did this, what would happen? And like when it comes to the world of AI, you can read all you like, but you really got to get in and try things. Like you got to experiment. You got to try and make something. Otherwise, you're not really experiencing it. And
yeah.
So like I like to read a lot, but I'm a big fan of doing. So like make something, see what happens, find out where it fell down and be enthusiastic, but understand there's going to be limitations. You know?
Yeah. 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 I love that point about being skeptical, not cynical. I think I was riddled with cynicism a few years ago, Paul. But it's one of the reasons why we started Call to Action was trying to cure my natural cynicism that I just kind of felt creeping in more and more. And I think I've done it fairly successfully, but of course it does still rear its ugly head from time to time.
Well, I wasn't so much cynical, but I was very arrogant at an early. I did an MBA when I was like 20 years ago.
A proper full fat one as well, not a mini one.
Yeah. But what happened was this: I did an MBA. I was working at O2 at the time. I was always the most knowledgeable person in the room about my very specific area, you know. And like I'd read every book about everything to do with any kind of marketing communications. Like I'd gone deep on everything on direct marketing, like right down to like catalog size, image pages, like ink to paper ratio, like all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I kind of knew it all, but I ended up being like having a lot of knowledge, but not being very wise. And I had this kind of arrogance and I would shut people down in meetings. I would close them off. I'd scorn at their like ridiculous kind of lack of like marketing structures and all sorts of things. And I was only my manager. I had a great manager called Johnny Cowell. And he was like, Paul, listen, like, you know, all the stuff, but when you stop like giving everybody a hard time about it. And I realized that basically my ego had just completely taken over. Like that's part of the mistake making that I talk about in the book, which is when you, like I made this mistake some years later where I launched this big campaign and it wasn't successful. And part of it is like I made schoolboy errors, like mistakes that you just shouldn't make. But when I got under the skin of when I was writing the book of why I made it, it was partly to do with the psychology of if you're in charge and you're the established expert in an area, and if you tell people this is going to work for these following reasons, and especially if you sound knowledgeable about these things, then it's very hard for you to turn back and turn around and go, actually, I've made a mistake. Let's not do it. Because you look like a fool. You think you're going to get fired. And so all those things are kind of psychological and they play on your brain. And it makes it very hard for people to put up their hand and say, I've made a mistake. I can't, we shouldn't do this. I'll give you an example. I don't know if this is going to talk, but like when I worked in the lottery, so post book, you asked me about mistakes, right? So after writing this book, I worked in the lottery as their CMO. And we had this really good run of just really good thinking, good advertising, good results. It was really good. And then we made this campaign about scratch cards. And we shot the campaign, like made it, everything like that. And then I put it into research with System One and it came back at like a low, like 2.5 star, which is, we were getting 4.5, 5 star ads. And I was like, oh, what's up with this? And I knew it wasn't as good as some of our other ones, but I was surprised that I was surprised at the low score. So I did this kind of quasi-qual research where I get open box verbatims, like 1,000 open box verbatims. So I was able to read like what 1,000 people thought about this piece of advertising. And I found 10% of people felt a little bit, like 90% were fine with it, but 10% really didn't like it. They felt a little bit upset by it. There was a kind of a joke in it that didn't land with everybody. And like maybe a little bit offended. So I said, what are we going to do? And it's a big brand in the country, and it's got a lot of political oversight. Like if you were a smaller brand and you're like, you didn't have allegiance to kind of the country and things like that, you could probably make a decision. But I was like, I really can't have 10% of my audience feel offended by this. So I called my CEO and said, listen, that campaign that we were hopefully going to launch in 2 weeks time or 3 weeks time, I said, I'm going to pull it. I said, it's, I explained to him why. And he, being a very smart man, he was like, okay, I get it. He says, do you know why you made the mistake? And I said, yeah. And he says, have you figured out what to do about it? I said, yeah. And I said, listen, can I do a section on the all hands next week? So this is where the whole company comes together. And so I stood up and showed a couple of charts of the mistake I'd made, and here's how it looked, and explained that I was pulling it, and it was cost a couple hundred grand, like it wasn't a small thing. And the reason I did it was we had this really long run of doing really good work, and I had made a mistake. I shouldn't have made it, but I did. And I wanted my team to see that you have to own these things. But I also wanted the company to know, because otherwise there would have been rumors and whispers. What happened to that campaign? I thought we were getting ready to launch and all sorts of things. So I thought it was important. But I know that 10 years previously, I'm not sure if I would have been able to do that. I'm not sure if I would have known what was the right thing to do. And the right thing to do is to say, I've made a mistake. Let's not spend a load of media money on something that is not the right thing to do, even though there may be personal kind of implications for making that mistake. Yeah, so there I am making the same mistake I made that I wrote about previously, but how I dealt with it was better than maybe I would have done in the past, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's really wise in terms of, I suppose, controlling the narrative and not allowing rumors to spread, but more so from a kind of non-egotistical perspective, it's a really impressive thing to do as well. So that's a great story.
Yeah, and I wanted my team to know they could do these things, but I guess I should say I was in an environment where I knew I could own up to a mistake without getting fired.
Yeah.
So if that culture hadn't existed, not sure how brave you'd be. But I knew it did.
There's a privilege to being in a culture like that, of course. But then equally, you need to be, you need to actually stand up and do what you did. So kudos.
Yeah, yeah. But there you go. Making mistakes still, even after writing about them. And it was a schoolboy error. It was like many of them, you know.
I'm going to move to listener questions. I'm just mindful of time. So I reckon we can get a couple in at least. So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. I'm going to stick to two, I think that's probably why. So Chelsea asks, if you could embed one chapter of Run With Foxes into every marketer's brain, which would it be and why?
You know what? It's probably chapter one. So chapter one is I didn't wear a seatbelt, and that's essentially that's getting under the skin of mistakes, which is, so the analogy is you could not wear a seatbelt, right, and get home safe, right? But doesn't mean not wearing a seatbelt was a good decision. It was a bad decision. So the idea that you may equate the outcome with your decision-making process is flawed. Because clearly not wearing a seatbelt is not a good idea. And so I think that, I guess, I didn't realize it was chapter one, but that's chapter one, which is essentially the idea of understanding the decisions you're making and learning to not equate an outcome with your decision-making process is probably the first and foremost thing I would kind of embed into an organization. There is another one, which is harder, which is like understanding the return on your spend. So like, because actually in the book, I don't know what the chapter is, but it might be maybe titled here somewhere, but I have a thing in it, which is the first thing I do. Probably should have been it. Chapter 4 is the first thing I do. And that is the first thing I do if I was joining a marketing function. And funny enough, when I started Lottery, that was the first thing I did in week one, which is I tracked down a wonderful woman called Louise to help me do some econometric modeling. So I said, look, it's going to take me a few months to get results, but let's start to understand how much profit our marketing activity drives. And so that is not going to be this thing that just keeps coming up time and time again. And it turns out like that the return on advertising and marketing in the lottery is very profitable. So it was quite helpful.
Yeah, amazing. Good answer. Question two is from Elliot. Elliot asks, SaaS companies, so software as a service companies, aren't known for taking a right brain approach to advertising. How can you add some much needed creativity in a left-brained industry?
Yeah, I think it's getting better. It's funny because I think a lot of the marketers in these organizations haven't come from consumer B2C type organizations. So they're just not even familiar with a lot of the work from Ehrenberg Bass or from Peter Field or Paul Feldick. It's just not their world. And so there's a lot of education to be done. And I think, you know, like I have this phrase is if you can't go in the door, go in the window, you know? So I think you just got to find a way to see if you can get some small results and get people excited about those things. It depends on the culture of the company and depends on the category. Sometimes companies don't need something or they don't know they need it until they discover they need it. Like a lot of advertising is about protecting market share. Like, for example, you know, do you know the famous quote from Jeff Bezos about like advertising? You only advertise if you don't have a good product. And then forward like 5 years later, and like they're the biggest advertisers in the country. Yes. You know, a lot of the learning is if you've gained market share, you might decide the reason you need to advertise and do some proper advertising and marketing is you need to protect that market share, or even better, you want to protect your price premium, you know, which is the which is where a lot of the profit comes from, which is, you know, am I willing to spend more for this product? I will if I have, you know, if I think the value proposition is worth it, and advertising is really good at doing that. And within that, just the world of what good advertising is, I see a lot of fights break out over like the word emotion in advertising, and my preference is to talk about memorable advertising and memorable communications, because when you talk about emotion, it sends people into all sorts of different avenues. But if you can get to a stage where you are like, do you want stuff that's going to be memorable, that will be remembered, and if the answer is yes, then you can head down a conversation, which is, well, what would make it more memorable? You know, so my big piece is I sometimes think that my LinkedIn connections are this strange mix of people from your world, Giles, and my world, which is, you know, brand marketing communications and marketing effectiveness, like the world of advertising agency, big consumer brands, and then I have all the other connections, which is kind of like B2B, like go to market, like SaaS tech, influencer stuff. And it's like these two worlds have never met. Like there's people trying to say the funnel is a ridiculous thing that doesn't exist. It's a metaphor. And there's other people saying, look how you can perfect this funnel. And it's not that either right or wrong. It's just like it's almost like two separate worlds, you know?
I couldn't agree more. The vast majority of the work we do here at Gasp is not just B2B, but it's very niche B2B often. And the vast majority within that client base have never heard of Ehrenberg Bass. They have not heard of Bennett and Field, Richton, whoever it is, Jenny Womanek. But you get the owner of one of these businesses, and they're incredibly impressive businesses, a lot of them, and talk to them about how many of their market are in market or protecting their price premium, et cetera. And they know it. They just don't know it in the words of, I don't know, the LinkedIn B2B Institute or whatever it might be. And that's what I find, like there's parallels with exactly what you're saying, because it's so true. It's so true.
Yeah. And I think it's good. I quite enjoy having the mix of those things. I do think it's entertaining that they don't know each other, as in they don't live in each other's worlds. I would say, in my experience in B2B, they're very customer focused. You know what I mean? Like, they genuinely have a deep insight and understand their customers. They haven't got, like, a lot of them don't have the muscle for, you know, to do marketing campaigns. But the other thing is this, the for all the talk, like, a lot of advertising isn't profitable, right? So I've worked on consumer brands for years. Like, you know, I interviewed Professor Tim Ambler from my book, and he passed away a few months ago. But, you know, he's like, obviously he was like an accountant and then an amazing marketer and then a professor. He wrote like Marketing in the Bottom Line. He's a talk about like marketers. They would just like, they would hold off trying to figure out the return on their investment long enough for them to move on to a new job. So like there's a sense of, and this is where I see kind of arrogance kicking in from different subgroups, where people think everything's right and everything's wrong. And unfortunately, it doesn't make good headlines, but it comes back to our kind of our hero, Paul Feldick, again, where, you know, I've often heard him say the best answer is it depends. You know, like, that's unfortunately, it depends is often the first right answer, because context matters. But it doesn't sell headlines. Like, it doesn't have that same kind of clickbaitiness that you might get from like the masters from Ritson and stuff, you know.
Yeah, you need certainties and absoluteness, don't you, to
in many ways, like, cause like again, like, Peter Field's a very balanced man in his, like, his views on stuff, but some of his things have been captured, you know, like, so their 60-40 has been captured, and it's like, but like, I see a lot of these things like bandied around without them understanding the context of, oh, how you got to those numbers, when do those numbers make sense, when do they not make sense, like, even the, like, what exactly is sales activation? Like, so what do you categorize as sales activation? How do you know if something is sales activation versus not? A lot of people don't go into that. We do that, like, we used to tag all these things very well in the lottery, so we had a really good understanding of those things. But you need to get people on the same page with the same language, which is also a problem.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, semantics is such an issue in this industry.
Yeah.
Brilliant. The final part of the interview then, Paul, is our four pertinent poses that we put to all of our guests. Number one being, what advice would you give to your younger self, a young Paul, reading his 7 books in the hospital?
Yeah, like, as in, so back then?
Yeah, if you could go back and give yourself some advice.
Yeah, okay, that's good. So, yeah, I would definitely ask him to read the book I wrote. That would be helpful. Would have saved making some of those mistakes. Yeah. I do you know what I did? One of the mistakes I made is I started off in small companies before moving into a larger company. I often advised like younger marketers to get into really good companies, like, you know, get to companies where they do marketing really well so you can learn from them. I had to figure a lot of stuff myself when I started out. And what I should have done is worked really hard to try and get into a Diageo or a Heineken or a P&G or a Google or something like that. So I think that's something I would have said back then as well. I like, for my own kids now, for example, I like, my kids are young, but they like, my kids learn how to create artwork from AI, create videos, drop it into CapCut, add music, they create music from AI, edit it, add in like text and stuff. I would ask anyone to do that.
Sadly, we have to end the episode almost there. We run into a few tech issues. We lost the internet. Paul did manage to cling on. Thank you, Paul, for some time tethering to his mobile device. But ultimately, tech won, and we weren't able to get the rest of the pertinent poses to Paul. But it was an amazing episode, and I'm hugely grateful, Paul, that you managed to hang on for as long as you did. Paul did ask to dedicate the episode to Peter Field. Peter did come up earlier in the conversation. So it's no huge surprise, but it's nice to hear Paul stress what a wonderful influence Peter has been on his career, both a mentor and an advisor. It was Peter who originally suggested Paul Wright run with Foxes, and Paul describes him as smart and generous. So this episode is very proudly dedicated to Mr. Peter Field. Now, as a final call to action, you can head over to this episode as usual. All the links will be there, everything we've discussed with Paul. Thank you for joining us. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do share and review the podcast. We value your support hugely. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online or email calltoaction@gasp.agency. I can't get no call to action. I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try, and I try. I can't get no call to action. Oh, I can't get no call to action. Yeah, hey, hey.